This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Supply and demand, the basic law of economics, right? So today, oil, our supply is up. So too is our demand. Funny how that works, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 21st of January, here with the podcast for this date. It's good to have you with us, everybody. We are, that is, Americans are, far and away the biggest consumers of crude oil in the world. We have been for decades now, despite conservation and increased efficiencies. The Chinese have been gaining on us. Their use has been growing faster than ours as their economy has grown and ours has been stuck, for want of a better word. That pattern held until last year, but we learned this morning that for the first time in more than a decade, the U.S. demand for oil grew even faster than China's. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story for us.
The International Energy Agency, or IEA, keeps track of which countries use how much oil. And the U.S. is always at the top of the list. Matt Perry is senior oil market analyst for IEA. He says every day here in the U.S., we use 19 million barrels of oil.
This is of a total of just below 92 million barrels every single day.
China comes in second at about half our level. In recent years, China's demand has been growing, while demand here has been slouching. But not in 2013. U.S. demand rose 2%.
The strength of it has exceeded, I think, everybody's expectations.
Why? In part, the answer has to do with the recession and recovering from it. Growth is easy when you've been in the pits. Peter Hartley is an economist at Rice University.
As the economic activity picks up, there's a lot more transportation going on.
More people driving to more jobs, more trucks delivering more things. And something else. We're drilling our own oil and natural gas. Supply is up. Prices are down.
And that's really stimulating a renaissance of the petrochemicals industry in the United States.
Plastics, chemicals, fertilizers, we're making more of them here now. But don't expect U.S. demand will continue to rise. The IEA says petrochemical companies in the U.S. are pretty maxed out. And our cars are only going to get more fuel efficient. Mark Schwartz is president of Pyra Energy Group, a consulting firm.
Over time, we think that U.S. demand is probably going to be flat at best and probably trending a bit down.
China, on the other hand, likely has a whole lot of growth in its future. As more folks there look to buy cars, travel, consume more like we do here in the U.S. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Crude in New York today, by the way, up about 0.7%, half a buck or so, $94.88 a barrel, should you be curious. We've all heard about Target's credit card breach and Neiman Marcus's. TJ Maxx had one a couple of years back, Citibank as well. That despite a well-known and widely used, in countries other than the U.S., I should say, a widely used technology that could have kept everybody's data safe and saved banks a whole lot of money. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
There is a thing called chip and PIN credit card technology. Chester Wisneski is a senior security advisor with Sophos.
It actually has a little cryptographic chip embedded right into the credit card instead of the stripe on the back like you're accustomed to.
It's not invincible, but it is much more secure than those magnetic stripes, and it's used in most credit cards in the rest of the world.
The types of breaches we've seen recently would have been prevented by the use of this chip and PIN technology.
So why do we still have these old-fashioned insecure cards with brown stripes that are constantly getting stolen?
Well, one of the big obstacles is the expense.
Bill Hardkopf is with LowCards.com, a consumer resource website.
retailers would have to get a different credit card processor, probably about a $200 expense per terminal for each checkout lane.
That's especially hard for smaller businesses, and card issuers and banks would have to pay for more expensive cards, but that doesn't explain why we're behind the rest of the world. Well, one reason is some governments forced people to adopt it. Ours didn't. Andrew Davidson is a senior vice president at Mintel.
There wasn't really the same demand to address fraud in the United States as there was in other parts of the world.
Wasn't. There is now.
Now is the time that the U.S. should upgrade to chip technology.
Carolyn Balfany is a senior vice president at MasterCard. They've been pushing the new technology in the U.S. for 2 years. Banks have just started to issue chip cards, and now MasterCard has set up a major incentive to get retailers to switch over by October 2015.
What it does is it does shift the liability to the organization that has not adopted the technology.
Usually, a bank has to cover a bogus purchase, but in 2015, a retailer will have to suck it up if it hasn't changed its card reader. Visa has set a similar deadline for a year later, so in the next 2 years, the U.S. may finally join the rest of the world. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not great, not terrible, but not great either. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Davos, or Davos, who knows? The World Economic Forum, 4 days of profound thoughts with presidents and prime ministers, CEOs and billionaires rubbing elbows. 2,500 business, political, and media elite on a mountaintop somewhere in the Swiss Alps. What's not to like, right? Some, though, take a more skeptical view of proceedings, as Marketplace's Stephen Beer tells us.
What's really going on at Davos? David Rothkopf of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says a lot of bloviating.
When I use the term bloviate, I mean that there are a lot of people there who love to hear themselves talk that go on at length. That mountaintop in Switzerland each year is warmed by quite a bit of hot air.
Alpine retreat is the perfect place for lofty thinking about the state of the world, say devotees. Anthony Hilton, financial editor of the London Evening Standard, isn't one of them.
They go on about the spirit of Davos and how they are shaping the world and so on. And they're not. They're actually reveling in their own self-importance and smugness, an exercise in self-preening and groupthink.
The gigantic agenda seems well-meaning. Among the 250 subjects under discussion, climate change, the future of healthcare, the nightmare of youth unemployment. But some items appear gloriously out of place in this well-heeled assembly.
One of the big themes this year is, I kid you not, income inequality.
John Reeves of the Motley Fool Financial Services Group is another Davos skeptic.
It's ironical that income inequality is the theme and you've got to pay $40,000 to go there and weigh in.
That's the estimated average cost per attendee, including travel, accommodation and getting into the event. Forget all that guff about making the world a better place, says Anthony Hilton. It's all about money and status. Once investment bankers got involved, he says, Davos went downhill.
They started throwing parties, obviously to get business, and it now has become almost a competition to see who gets invited to the most exclusive parties. So the whole spirit of it has gone by the board.
But Davos must be doing something right. 1,000 corporations keep it afloat, pumping in around $200 million a year. Yes, it is a gab fest, but so what, asks Martin Wolf of the Financial Times. We need a talking shop, he says. Contacts forged at Davos may have helped the world weather the financial crisis.
I think one of the reasons our world hasn't collapsed quite in the way that it did in the first half of the 20th century is that people just keep talking. I happen to believe that talking is quite a good thing to do.
And with 40 heads of state attending, 20 central bank chiefs and numerous tycoons and Nobel laureates, Davos is a talking shop we cannot afford to ignore. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Ben Bernanke's got just about a week left as the most powerful man in the universe. 10 days, to be precise. His term as chairman of the Federal Reserve is up at the end of the month. It's not like he's going to retire, though. He's still got plenty of utility left to be very economist-minded about it. And in fact, there was speculation in the Wall Street Journal today that he might wind up at the Brookings Institution, one of the big names in Washington think tanks, a big name with big money behind it. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to have a look at the economics of big ideas.
According to tax filings, the five richest think tanks in the U.S. have more than $1.5 billion in assets. That's about the GDP of Liberia.
Let's face it, there's a lot of money at stake here.
That's Peter Metzger, vice chairman of CT Partners in Washington. He's a think tank headhunter. Metzger says even if you're not a famous Washington wonk like Ben Bernanke, think tanks pay pretty well.
Some in the neighborhood of $750,000 to $1 million or more, depending upon their experience and what they can bring to the effort.
But what do the big names do for a think tank? Why are they so prized? The best-known wonks are big money makers. They might make an appearance at a fundraiser. If they make a speech, the think tank can charge admission. James McGann runs the Think Tanks and Civil Societies program at the University of Pennsylvania. He says sometimes just a really big name on a think tank's letterhead is enough to get the donations flowing.
Those that have a strong brand, which is connected to, you know, the rigor of their research, are key.
Think tank donors include foundations, interest groups, and increasingly corporations, which see the influence of think tanks as a way to pierce Washington gridlock. Some think tanks have even set up separate arms that can lobby Congress, according to Jack Pitney, who teaches political science at Claremont McKenna College.
A lot of the organizations are really conglomerates of different kinds of groups, depending on what kind of contributions they're trying to draw.
But Pitney says for all the money involved, think tanks aren't trying to make a profit. In fact, they're nonprofits, more interested in the real currency of Washington, power and influence. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, a multi-billion-dollar brand with a serious image problem.
After 30 years, my love and respect for the game is fading. And I'm seriously considering giving up football completely.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 44 points today, 0.25%, closed at 16,414. The NASDAQ advanced 28 points, 0.33%, 42.25 at the close. The S&P 500 up 5 points. About 0.25%, closed at 1843 there. Travelers moved down 1.7% despite beating fourth quarter earnings and revenue expectations. Analysts had said new business declined. Verizon rang down 1.3%, although it increased subscriber numbers. The phone company agreed to buy an Intel business unit focused on the development of online TV products and services. Bond prices? Well, thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is scheduled to convene its annual winter meeting in Washington. The president of the conference is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. I hope he has a warm coat. The North American International Auto Show continues in Detroit. And the actress who gave us a whole new interpretation of Split Pea Soup celebrates her birthday. Exorcist star Linda Blair turns 55. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We love our pork, we Americans do. We like it in virtually all of its forms, as an ingredient in almost any concoction we can think of. But that taste for bacon doesn't come cheap. Pork prices hit a record high last year. They may well go up again in 2014. And that has created something of a pricing issue for businesses trying to feed our bacon cravings, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
I'm in a highbrow part of New York at a highbrow restaurant, and I'm about to eat a brow.
This is pig's head. Enjoy.
You heard that right. Pig's head. Actually, it's half a pig's head, brined and deep fried and served on a salad, teeth and all. crispy suckling pig face has become one of the most popular dishes at New York restaurant Maialino, which means suckling pig in Italian. Pig face's popularity even surprised executive chef Nick Anderer.
I never thought that a dish of a pig's face on a plate would sell as much as it does. This one does.
Part of the push to use more pig parts has to do with pork prices. They hit a 30-year high last year. Steve Meyer heads Paragon Economics, an agriculture market consulting firm.
When corn goes up, everything goes with it.
Pigs eat a lot of corn, and corn prices have been at record highs. They've dropped a lot recently, so pork prices were poised to plunge. But now a deadly illness from China is hitting pig populations in the U.S., and that's likely to keep prices high, says Meyer.
But now we're facing some supply challenges caused by a viral disease in baby pigs.
While the supply of pigs might be shrinking, demand for pork has been flying high.
Bacon has been a very big food trend.
Brand consultant Deborah Kay says our cultural tastes have evolved and we're embracing bacon like never before. Bacon donuts, bacon cocktails, bacon chocolates, bacon flavored.
We started to see that sweet, smoky, salty could go together. And what is better as salty and smoky than bacon? And that's really, really started to take off.
Bacon flavored vodka, bacon ice cream, bacon lip balm. Anyway, all this new demand plus the low supply means the price of pork goes up. That's Econ 101, right? Maialino chef Nick Anderer says it's not quite that simple.
Yes, pork prices spiked last year, and we made no price hikes with our pork dishes because we just didn't feel that the perceived value would be there. Ultimately, pork is a comfort food to me, and once you start charging, you know, luxury prices for it, it kind of takes it into a realm for us that I don't feel comfortable with.
Restaurants can get away with big markups for beef. Here in New York, a fancy restaurant can charge $40 for a ribeye. But pork is kind of the people's meat. It's really hard to charge $40 for a pork chop. And restaurants can't not offer pork because we are a nation obsessed with bacon. Faced with this pork pricing puzzle, Andrew's done two things. The first is stretching the pork.
If it's such a great seasoning agent, it doesn't need to be the main focus of a dish. Just be a few ounces of torn meat with some malfatti pasta and arugula, and then you got yourself a great dish. And
the other solution is to use more parts of the pig.
We sell a lot more weird pork dishes now than we ever did before.
Including charred pig hearts, pig liver crostini, crispy pork skin served with vinegar, and, of course, pig face. Brand consultant Deborah Kay says our deep love of bacon is pushing us to brave new frontiers of pork eating. She agreed to try Andrew's famous pig face.
All right, so what I normally do is I take the ear first.
Oh, that's so good. Oh, my God. You know, the thing I give Figaro, my dog, for dessert every night is a pig's ear. Now I don't think I want to give it to him anymore.
The pork puzzle for people may be solved this year. The pork puzzle for dogs, well, might be just beginning. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We talked earlier in the program about oil, which, along with the other fossil fuels, is based on carbon, element number 6 in the periodic table, symbol C. Our every now and then contributor Justin Rowlett from the BBC program Business Daily has been working on a series about individual chemical elements and how they affect the global economy. It's called Elementary Economics. Justin, good to talk to you again.
Very good to talk to you, Kai.
I must say, carbon, carbon, carbon. It's all we hear. Carbon, carbon, carbon.
Carbon, an absolutely essential element, fundamental to life itself. In fact, it's so important that in our series we've been doing, Elementary Economics on the Role of the Elements in the World Economy, we've divided carbon into two. We're doing carbon energy and then carbon structures.
Let's do carbon energy, right? Because that is both the source of so much of our energy, but the source of a huge amount of, you know, climactic problems.
It is indeed. Let's go back to first principles. Carbon binds with hydrogen in plants, creates a store of energy that plants can use. And obviously, over millions and millions of years, some dead plants, they've become the oil, the coal, the gas that we rely on.
In fact, carbon itself has been commoditized, right? We have carbon markets. You have carbon emissions markets over there. We've tried some over here. It is in and of itself a thing.
Yeah, it is a thing. It is a thing. I mean, but the carbon markets in Europe haven't worked particularly well. I mean, people would argue that we've given away too many credits to emit carbon dioxide. But you have hit a thing. I mean, it's linking the price of the fossil fuel with the effect of the carbon dioxide on the atmosphere that's been the problem. And lots of economists and scientists would say one of the big problems we've got is that we don't price in the effects of the carbon dioxide produced by the energy we use on the Earth. And we should be paying a little bit more, or some would say quite a lot more, for our energy to persuade us to seek out other ways of finding energy.
Here's a mundane question. How does one measure carbon dioxide? Because it's by the ton, right?
Well, you measure it by the ton, but actually, you know, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, I mean, scientists can isolate the carbon dioxide molecules. It's actually a very tiny proportion of the atmosphere is carbon dioxide. But the crucial thing about carbon dioxide is that it absorbs infrared radiation and warms up. And it's that warming that creates the so-called global warming effect. Even small quantities of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere increase the ability, the kind of blanket that the Earth has around it that keeps the Earth warm.
One does wonder what would have happened if we had never discovered the energy-storing properties of carbon, right?
Well, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at. I mean, before the Industrial Revolution, economic growth was very, very slow, about 0.1% a year. And this went on for millennia. I mean, by some estimates, the hunter-gatherers 10,000 years ago had better nutrition and better lifestyles than peasants in Europe. So it's only the Industrial Revolution that created this engine of economic growth that has powered our economies to grow as they have over the last, you know, in Britain's case, 300 years, and most of the rest of the world, 200 years.
If I had a bucket full of this stuff, if I had a bucket full of carbon, could I do anything with it?
Well, I mean, you've got to remember, carbon comes in all kinds of forms. Diamonds, of course, are carbon. Coal is carbon. Graphite is carbon. That's one of the reasons why carbon's such an interesting element. It comes in so many different forms. So I think your bucket of carbon, well, it could be a bucket of oil, I suppose, or it could you know, maybe a bucket of diamonds. You've got to tell me what kind of carbon you've got.
I want the bucket of diamonds. Justin Rowlett at the BBC. Justin, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Kai. Good luck with that bucket of diamonds of yours.
Well, I'll let you know. I'll let you know. You better believe the National Football League has its eyes on the weather in New York City. Today, the Super Bowl is at MetLife Stadium out at the Meadowlands in New Jersey in a couple of weeks. That would be the outdoor roofless MetLife Stadium. It's going to be Seattle versus Denver, as you know, and we are already getting a taste of the ads that are going to run. Parties are being planned and bets are being made. Not, however, by Roxanne Jones. She used to be vice president at ESPN. She has been a diehard NFL fan her whole life. And now she's thinking about walking away.
I fell in love on a Monday night. Now, many might say that a teenage girl can't know about such things, but that night, as I watched the Dallas Cowboys running back Tony Dorsett roll downfield 99 yards for a touchdown, I fell head over heels in love with the NFL. It was January 3rd, 1983, Dallas versus Minnesota. Tony Dorsett was so free, so graceful, and so powerful to me. And watching him break free of all of his competitors, those who wanted to bring him down and stop him from reaching his goal, I was in awe. And I knew then that his run capsulized all that I wanted to accomplish in my life. That football game is one of my most cherished childhood memories. I've been a passionate NFL fan since that moment. Though I did switch my loyalties to the Philadelphia Eagles, my hometown team. I ended up spending much of my career in sports journalism, a dream job if ever there was one. But after 30 years, my love and respect for the game is fading, and I'm seriously considering giving up football completely. I've come to this pass because of the NFL's concussion crisis. The NFL has consistently denied any connection.
but many of the men who play the game feel differently. When I watch the games today, the awe is gone. And I thank God that my son never wanted to play football, that it was basketball that stole his heart. Today, instead of telling kids how football inspired me to go after what I want in life, I advise them and their parents to avoid the game at all cost. It's not safe at any level. I've worked with former NFLers who suffer blackouts in mid-sentence after being diagnosed with numerous concussions over their careers. And many of us knew Junior Seau and other football players who've taken their own lives. And too many of us in the sports industry stood by and watched yesterday's heroes implode or fall into depression in retirement. If my beloved NFL continues to lie and deny while men and boys are suffering and dying, well, then it's time for this fan to say goodbye.
Roxanne Jones is a CNN opinion columnist. You can find this and all of our commentaries online at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Final notes today. Yes, that was plural. There will be two. Item number one, in which I resolve this year to finally fill out a bracket for the NCAA basketball tournament come March. It comes courtesy, this final does, of Warren Buffett. He is going to team up with the mortgage lender Quicken Loans and give anybody who picks a perfect bracket, that is, correctly predicts the winner of every single game in the tourney, and there are 63 games, a cool $1 billion. How hard can that be? Well, I'm seeing odds of 1 in 9.2 quintillion against me, so pretty hard, apparently. Item two, just to put a capper on Stephen Beard's Davos story, on the agenda for the gathering of the world's most rich and powerful and elite people, Goldie Hawn, yes, that Goldie Hawn, giving a talk on the ways and that, here I quote, neuroscience, mindfulness training, and social and emotional learning can change the world. So, that. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 44 points, about a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 28 points, 0.6%. There, the S&P 500 up 5 points, nearly 0.3%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Same bat time, same bat channel. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.